This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Robin Dow is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Today is the 31st day of January. On this date in 1947, Nolan Ryan, the Hall of Fame pitcher, was born in Refugio, Texas. He's 76 years old. He struck out 5,714 batters in his career. Put that in perspective, that means if somebody struck out 300 a year for 19 consecutive years, they would still be 14 strikeouts behind the Ryan Express. And on this date, Norman Mailer, the great writer, was born 100 years ago, and we will remember him later in the hour, but we have a special treat. We start with the head football coach at Tulane University, and he is the toast of the town after leading the Greenies to an amazing season. They finished ninth in the final poll, fourth in the NCAA computer. LSU, by the way, is number 20. And Willie Fritz did this with a budget of just over $5 million. LSU's budget, by the way, $51 million for football. LSU invests more on women's basketball than Tulane does in football. So they're playing on different planes monetarily, but when it comes to results, last year was a better year for the Green Wave. And Willie Fritz is a guy who's been around the block. He's been head coach at the University of Central Missouri, Sam Houston State, Georgia Southern. And he also, from 93 to 96, was a head coach at Blinn College, a junior college in Texas. He led his team to consecutive National Junior College Association National Championships in 95 and 96. And he has the Green Wave on the rise. And good morning to you, Coach Fritz.
Well, hey, good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. And that game against USC in the Cotton Bowl was one for the ages, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a heck of a day for Tulane University in the city of New Orleans. We had over 30,000 people there at Arlington Stadium and in the Dallas Metroplex area. And they were loud and proud. Just a great day. You know, how the finish, everything worked out well, too. But just proud of our team and our university for and all the fans of Tulane coming out in force.
Mm-hmm. And Tulane has a great football tradition. The Greenies back in the day were in the Southeastern Conference and won three SEC titles as a member of the SEC. And seven current members of the conference have never done that, including people like Kentucky and Vanderbilt and, of course, Arkansas and A&M and Missouri and South Carolina. They have Mississippi State. They have not done what Tulane did back in the day, but Tulane withdrew from the SEC in the mid-60s. In retrospect, Coach, I know you're kind of a newbie, but it would be nice to be back in the Southeastern Conference, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't see that happening. I wasn't around when they made the decision about getting out of the Southeastern Conference. But, we feel like we're in a super league. I'm glad they've expanded the college football playoffs with 12 teams, and we would have been in it this year if they would have had that expansion in line this season. But I think there's a lot of teams like us who can make a run in a national championship and can play against teams like USC. So we're excited about being in the American Athletic Conference, very competitive from top to bottom. And, the goal that we have right now is just continuing the direction that we're going right now. You made the comment a little earlier that Tulane's had some great teams, which they certainly have, and I made mention of that in my initial press conference 7 years ago, but just haven't done it consistently, and that's our goal. We want to be able to do this consistently.
877-217-5757 for Coach Willie Fritz of the Tulane Green Wave, National Coach of the Year, and his team won its conference title and beat mighty USC, and the Trojans were pretty good. They had a Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback. And Tulane knocked him off in the Cotton Bowl, and just an amazing game. Have you ever been in a game like that before?
I've coached a lot of games. I think I've coached over 300 games as a head football coach at a whole lot of different levels, junior college, Division II, 1AA, and now at the highest level of football, the Division I level. But I don't know if I've had a finish in a game of that magnitude before in my career. The kids just kept plugging away and fighting to the bitter end. And, you know, we had a little bit of good fortune. We had a kickoff late in the game, and a guy for USC, you know, fumbled the ball out of bounds at the one. We got a safety and scored, I believe, with 8 seconds left in the game to win it. So it was a very exciting finish, you know, and I don't know if I've been in a game quite like that, but I'm just happy that we were on the right side of it.
Well, where do you go from here? You have this great season, the greatest in Tulane history, according to many, and I wouldn't quarrel with that. And in the NIL world, you've got a great city. Dave Dixon used to say for recruits, this is like Paris. And in New Orleans is a great city, and you're in a wonderful part of the city. So there's a lot, and a great university. There's a lot to sell, but is it immensely challenging in this environment as we know it now?
Yeah, we sell three things. You know, number one, an opportunity to get a world-class education. We're the 39th ranked school academically out of 4,140 colleges and universities across the United States and Canada. You get an opportunity to play in a great conference and play, you know, high-level competition. We're always going to play, you know, teams out of the so-called Power Five. Next year, we're playing Ole Miss at home. You know, we played Oklahoma, Ohio State, Auburn, a bunch of, and obviously USC. And then last but not least, like you just said, you know, you get to do all this in the iconic city of New Orleans. And, you know, our guys really enjoy the experience here. You know, something that we do on our official visit, which is unique to any other school in the university, we just so they can see the city of New Orleans and understand the culture and the diversity that we have here in New Orleans. We do about a 15-block second line, and we do it in all the way, and we finish up at Jackson Square, and you know, at the end of the weekend, maybe some people that didn't know much about New Orleans, you know, are feeling good about the city. You know, we start with maybe 100 mm-hmm. people, the prospects, parents, families, coaches, and by the time we get to Jackson Square, we might have 500-600 people that jump in and join us on the second line. So we really show the city off, you know, because, you know, wherever you go to school, that's going to be a big part of your experience. And, you know, we feel like this is a different experience for college kids and one that they'll really, really enjoy.
877-217-5757. We will take a call or two for Coach Fritz. And we've gotten several emails, many too numerous to relate to the coach, but one, a good one. Would you like to see a game with LSU on an annual basis the way it used to be? Would that be plausible in this day and age?
You know, it's so difficult with scheduling and how many teams are in each conference. And, you know, we're scheduled out, I think, through 2031. You know, so we're scheduled out pretty far. I'm sure LSU is as well. I get that question all the time. Yeah, we'd like to do it if we could. You know, Tulane and LSU played for years and years and years against each other. And you know, I got a picture in my office of, you know, the biggest crowd in the history of Tulane Stadium at that time. It was the largest crowd in the South. I think they had almost 90,000 in old Tulane Stadium.
Right.
Here on campus. So, yeah, that'd be something that we'd like to do, but mm-hmm. it just is kind of tough with scheduling.
Yep, that was December 1st, 1973, Tulane 14, LSU nothing, Tulane Stadium. I was listening as a kid in Little Rock, 1605 Main Street, on my radio with John Ferguson's baritone voice calling the game. He wasn't happy that night. Tulane had a big evening and a fine team under Benny Ellender, and it's hard to believe it'll be 50 years this fall, and I'm sure you will commemorate that date in some major way. And our friend John Berry, the fabulous writer, was a coach on that team. And I think all the coaches last year got inducted in the Tulane Hall of Fame, didn't they?
Yeah, they put the team in, and which was long overdue. I was shocked when you know, someone told me that they were going to the Hall of Fame. I figured they would have been in the Hall of Fame 20, 30 years ago. But yeah, they all came back. It was, you know, it's so neat to watch these guys that are you know, a little bit older now, but they, you know, they, you know, just see each other, and there's that automatic bond, you know, that they had, you know, 50 years ago, as you just said, and you know, that was just, I got to spend the weekend with those guys at a big party, and, you know, it's also neat is you know, these guys are all really, really successful.
Well, yeah.
They've used that two-lane degree to their benefit.
Bill in Jefferson Place, please be concise, Bill. You're on with Coach Fritz.
All right, thank you. Congratulations, Coach, on a great season. It was really exciting for the students and the alumni and the city of New Orleans. I wanted to ask you questions about a couple of the players. One is Fat Watts. I know he got injured early in the season, and he was a senior, but does he have another was he able to redshirt and have another year of eligibility? And the other person I wanted to ask about was a running back that had been a vital part of the team for a couple of years previously, and he played three snaps, I think, or in the first game.
All right, we'll get the coach's response when we return, Bill, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and a few more minutes with Coach Willie Fritz, who is the toast of one of the great cities on the planet, New Orleans, and the Tulane Green Wave. They have alumni all over the country and in other parts of the world. It is an international school because of the quality of the university and, of course, the cosmopolitan setting of New Orleans. And anybody who goes there gets into Tulane football because the Greenies, they try their best. Some years are better than others. And last year, as in 2022, was an historic season for Tulane, led by this gentleman who's a lifer. He's a guy in his early 60s. He's coached in many places. Didn't go to a major university as far as football. But yet here he is at, 62 years old, coach? And it's like overnight recognition. You've been doing this a long time, and I want you to answer how it feels for you after all these years to get this kind of adulation, but also the question from our previous caller, Bill, about the personnel people he mentioned, including Watts. Your thoughts, Coach?
You bet. My wife told me the other day I might need to change my first name to 62-year-old Willie Fritz. I'm getting that quite a bit right now, but just every place that we've been, it's been a tremendous journey for myself, my wife, Susan. Been a lot of places, and, you know, Blinn Junior College, as you said before, I was an assistant at Coffeyville Community College, Sam Houston State, Central Missouri, Georgia Southern, and then over here now at Tulane, and we've just loved it every place we've been at. And this is a special, special place for us. It's, we love the city. We've had so much fun here. It probably took us 2 or 3 years to kind of get it figured out, but we really enjoy New Orleans and everything it has to offer. I try to hire guys, too, that maybe have had taken the same path as myself, because I think it's a lot easier to move up a level of football than to come down, and I'm just amazed at, you talked earlier about our budget and things like that. I'm just amazed by how good it is. I didn't have that in a lot of the other places.
I know.
That I coached at.
I know, yeah.
Fat Watts, I think the caller asked about Fat Watts.
Yep.
He tore his ACL and got hurt during the season. He's got another season for us. He's, everybody got an extra year with the COVID season. So he's going to have another year, and I was just out there on the field watching guys run and work out, and he's making progress towards being ready to go here in the fall.
Coach Willie Fritz, the name, it will become synonymous with Tulane football, and I think you're confident enough to believe you can keep this going. And some seasons, as stated, are better than others, and it's hard to replicate last year, but as you go into this year and beyond with a new NIL world, how do you sell Tulane with players now getting overdue compensation for their talents?
Well, that's part of it now. You've got to adapt and improvise. And I guess what has made us relevant over the years is being able to do that. We're fortunate that we've got a lot of Tulane alums who have been very, very successful, and they're helping us with the NIL program. But we're probably doing it a little bit different than other people. We're waiting for guys to come in and show what they can do rather than trying to attract them through the NIL. you know, but that's part of the game now. I've always, remember I had a great running back named Tim Flanders. He'll be in the College Football Hall of Fame, you know, at some point in time, and played for me at Sam Houston, and everybody in the crowd, there might be 500 people wearing a number 20 jersey, you know, but he didn't have one. You know, NCAA wouldn't provide for it. He didn't get any part of it. And so I do believe that they're, you know, the student athletes should get some type of compensation, especially the guys that are helping to promote the university and the program. But we just need to figure out how we're going to do this. We just kind of got thrown into it with no rules or regulations. And I think that's coming down the pike, that they're going to have some type of rules and regulations regarding NIL.
What about the transfer portal? Has that changed things dramatically as well?
Yeah, it has. You know, we've been very fortunate. This degree is, you know, a big time degree for these kids, and they want to get that degree. That's their number one goal. So we haven't lost very many kids since the transfer portal started a couple of years back. But you know, I think there's some good in it. You know, I had a student athlete who, you know, he kind of wanted to be the guy at his position, and we had some good guys at that position. So he'd already gotten his degree at Tulane, and he transferred someplace else, and heck, I helped him do it. You know, but I do think that sticking it out, you know, facing adversity, you know, fighting through adversity is a good trait to learn. And sometimes guys make a decision on a place, and, you know, they just got to fight through it a little bit. So we've been fortunate. We haven't lost very many kids. Most of them have been guys that maybe wanted to play more and, you know, went to another institution. But and we've also gained some kids. We've had some kids from New Orleans who, you know, thought the grass was a little greener someplace else.
Yeah.
And they found out it was only green, and they wanted to come back home. And so we've had some really good players that have come back home to New Orleans to play for us just because they wanted to be back home.
So
that's something you have to deal with.
You mentioned, Coach, the old Tulane Stadium. Now you have a relatively new arena, but it's much smaller. How is that working out?
Great. You know, it's Hillman Stadium, and, you know, it's a perfect size for us. It's 30,000. I think we sold it out three times this year. You know, there's nothing like our conference championship game and seeing the students and the crowd rush the field. I don't think Tulane ever had an opportunity to do that before. It's right in the center of campus. It's just off the footprint of the old Tulane Stadium. So we love it. It's a great venue to see a game. So often you go to these big stadiums and, you know, there's kind of a rumor of a game going on down there if you're up in the upper deck real high. You know, every seat's a perfect seat at Yulman Stadium.
Barry in Mid-City, you'll be our final caller for Coach Willie Fritz. Barry, good morning, sir.
Good morning. I wonder if the name, image, likeness thing is putting, maybe with all due respect, a little too much money into college athletics, please.
Well, I just, you know, we touched on that a little bit. I just think there needs to be a plan. I would love to see, you know, kind of dangling a carrot out there where you graduate and then you get the money that you earn during your career or part of it. I don't know what it might be, but it's here to stay. And, you know, we just got to figure out the right way to do it and see if we need to put some regulation on it to help the student athletes, not just during college, but when they, you know, when you go out and get that first job. You know, I remember when I got my first job, I didn't know anything about deposits and you need a good car that can run and things like that. So I'd love to see the student athletes be able to, you know, save some of that money and have it when they get out, but that probably won't happen.
I talked to the chiropractor for the LSU football team the other day, and he told me he was living on a diet of buffalo ribeye and lobster. They feed the players well. I suspect the greenies are fed pretty well too, aren't they?
You know, we've got a great training table that's right. You know, I'm in my office right now. I can walk down there. It takes me 45 seconds. It's right underneath the stadium, and I go down there and eat you know, two or three times a week, but I always hit Friday. That's Cajun Friday. And so we go down there and we have gumbo and, you know, catfish and jambalaya and everything that you can think of that's New Orleans flavor. So our guys eat very well.
Well, Coach Willie Fritz, congratulations on an amazing season, and we're glad you're here. And I think this may be the end of the trail for Willie and a fabulous career, and it looks like it will end gloriously. But we appreciate your time this morning, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Roll wave.
There you go. And in a moment, we will be joined by Michael Lennon, the biographer, archivist, and close friend of Norman Mailer, and the son, the last child of Norman Mailer and Norris Mailer, John Buffalo Mailer. They'll remember the great American man of letters born on this date 100 years ago. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and January 31st, 1923, Long Branch, New Jersey, Norman Mailer was born. He went on to have perhaps the most diverse writer's career ever. And it started when he was young, in 1948, when he was 25. The Naked and the Dead, considered by some as the greatest war novel of them all, was based on Mailer's stint in the Pacific during World War II. He was a giant of American letters, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, a winner of the National Book Award, originator of New Journalism, co-founder of The Village Voice, the author of 12 novels, lifelong activist, ran for mayor of New York City in 1969. He died in 2007 at the age of 84. And his close friend, J. Michael Lennon, who's been with us a few times, including in November on the 15th anniversary of Norman Mailer's death, he's with us along with the last child of Norman Mailer, John Buffalo Mailer, the son of two amazing people, Norman Mailer and Norris Mailer, who was with us shortly before she died. And they have collaborated for a new book that is out and about today, A Mysterious Country, The Grace and Fragility of American Democracy. Oliver Stone, of all people, says, Norman Mailer reminds us of what a great writer he was and many other things. He was a contrarian historian of our times, endlessly curious, as well as a psychic eye of a cyclops monster, ready to say the most outrageous things to provoke our thinking, a formidable debater and opponent who made even neutral folk want to fight him. Mailer was a conscience for this country, a fearless gunslinger of our national psyche. At the very least, although he may infuriate you and make you angry, at other times he will enlighten you. His is a new way of seeing. What more can a writer give us from none other than Oliver Stone? Michael Lennon, let's begin with you, my friend. We've visited a few times talking about the legacy of Norman Mailer, and it goes beyond his words, which were immense. He cared deeply about this country, and he was concerned about it until the day he died. And I'm sure he would have many things to say about what we're experiencing right now.
Yes, Jim, he would. And I can't tell you the number of people who have said to me, what would Norman Mailer make of the assault on the Capitol last year? What would Norman Mailer make of the presidency of Donald Trump? What would he feel? Would he still have the same feelings about the perils facing democracy at this time? And the answer to those is yes. If you look at all of his writing, which John and I did over the course of about 6 months, you will find this sort of a silver thread, vein running all through it about his deep abiding fears about democracy atrophying and failing because not enough attention is being paid, because there's not enough discussion between the left and the right, because there's too much selfishness and not enough worrying about the common weal. So that's why we put the book together, and that's we're so happy that it's coming out on this day, 100 years after he was born.
John Buffalo Mailer is an award-winning screenwriter, journalist, playwright, actor, producer, and he is with us. He is the co-writer, along with J. Michael Lennon, of this book, which is out and about today, Norman Mailer, A Mysterious Country, The Grace and Fragility of American Democracy. Now, John Buffalo Mailer was born after Norman Mailer was famous and had been famous for many decades. The only writer, by the way, to have number one, not number one, but bestsellers in 7 decades. But John Buffalo Mailer, did your dad talk a lot about his feelings for this country?
Hey, Jim, great to be here. Thank you so much. That was dinner table conversation every night that I can remember growing up with him. And it seems kind of appropriate that it's taken 100 years for the country to catch up to Norman Mailer's mind. So, you know, we definitely designed this book to be a very user-friendly lens into how we got to the place we find ourselves in today. You know, in a way, it's like Norman Mailer's History of the United States from 1947 to 2007. But what is really almost spooky is Mike and I went through, as he says, you know, all of his writings on democracy to winnow it down to this very user-friendly best of the best. A lot of it feels as if he's writing about America today, with the lens that he has of 100 years of wisdom. He was so prescient. And I think at the times he was writing, he was almost like Cassandra. You know, he was just shouting out, don't you see what's going to happen if you keep going down this road? And now we're here. So I don't think this book could come at a better time, frankly.
Your mother was an equal partner in this marriage. She was no intellectual slouch and quite a lady herself. Did the two of them often argue about politics and the state of the country and that sort of thing at the dinner table?
I mean, of all the things they had to argue about, I would say politics was probably low on the list. she was formidable. You know, we come from mule skinners in Arkansas on that side of the family, and my dad actually said that when he married her, he felt like he was marrying the American dream, pioneers and whatnot. So she held her own, but actually, when it came to politics, the two of them were pretty copacetic.
Yeah, I'm sure they agreed, but. Norman Mailer was one of those people who, even though he was a liberal, he vacillated. He did not have his mind made up, and that's part of being intellectually curious is that we want to be receptive to all ideas, and he was a guy who absorbed it all, didn't he?
Well, I think he actually might
have a sense of being...
Oh, sorry, Mike.
Go ahead, John.
He might take offense to being called a liberal. I think we could call him a radical. We could call him a left conservative. You know, he at various times called himself a man of the left, but later on, you know, kind of came to this radical center place, I guess. And these days it feels more radical than ever to try to wrap one's head around seeing both perspectives at once. You know, it's as if we live in two worlds now and you're only allowed to pick one. You can't actually have friends from both sides. So he was always trying to build bridges between polar opposites. He felt that was the only way we had a chance of saving democracy.
Michael Lennon, would you respond?
Let me add to that. Yeah, that's perfectly put, John. He was always always looking for that common ground between the left and the right. And many times at dinner conversations, he would take on positions that were let's say a little to the left of his positions or a little to the right of his positions to get a debate going. You didn't go to a dinner party with Norman Mailer when his family was there, his friends was there, everyone. There was always a political hot plate on the table, and Norman would push buttons to try to get people to say what they really felt, what they were really afraid of, what they were really worried about, what their deepest opinions were. He wanted to get that discussion going. I mean, the discussion, it was always a seminar when you had a dinner party with Norman Mailer. There was always this kind of discussion, and politics was invariably right in the center of it. I mean, there was discussions of sports and football and people and, you know, everything else, but politics was the thing that was that ran through all the discussions. That was the line that you could follow through over 30 or 40 years of dinner parties that I can remember with him.
We're hearing the voices of J. Michael Lennon, the biographer, friend, and archivist of Norman Mailer and John Buffalo Mailer, his son, who was born after Norman had become world famous. And John Buffalo Mailer was not around in 1969 when Norman Mailer ran for mayor of New York City, but he was around in 1996 when supposedly your dad was considering running for president of the United States of America. I presume as a Democrat, he would have been in the primary against the incumbent Bill Clinton. Was that something he seriously considered, John?
I think he seriously considered it until he had a conversation with my mother, who coincidentally had dated Bill Clinton back in Arkansas when he was first running for Congress.
She told us.
I can't quite remember if she said, if you do this, I'm going to leave you, or if she said, if you do this, I'm going to kill you. But it was one of the two, and either way, it chased him off that notion.
So that got him off that pretty quickly.
Real fast.
In your mother,
but he was serious about it.
He was serious. Michael, yeah. And he would have been, in many ways, Clinton's worst nightmare.
Yes, he would have. He had a lot of criticisms of Bill Clinton. He thought he was admirable in many ways, that he had great powers of charisma, speaking, and so on. But he called him a boutique president. He felt that Clinton never really took on the central issue in the United States, which was race relations, black-white relations. Norman felt until that was settled, this country was always going to be at each other. We're going to be at each other's throat. And so in 1996, he actually got in touch with Gene McCarthy. And McCarthy would be run for president and Norman for vice president. I remember vividly going to dinner with Norman at a restaurant in Provincetown, just the two of us. And he told me the whole idea. And I couldn't believe it. My mouth was open. I said, Norman, you are not up to running a presidential campaign. And he said, well, I know it'd be tough, but I'd have to get in shape. I'd have to do this. I'd have to do that. I said, I don't think it's going to work. And then, as John said, Norris just laid down the ultimatum. You're not going to do this. This is the craziest idea you've ever had. Don't even think about it. And ultimately, he dropped it.
He was 73 years old at the time, which by today's standards would make him a young man to run for president of the United States. This book, I'm sorry, John, you were going to say?
No, just appreciating the comments.
Yeah.
That's all.
And the book is full of Norman's writings on all kinds of things, and we'll talk in our final segment about some of the people that Norman Mailer talked with and then wrote about, including none other than Clint Eastwood and Warren Beatty, who, of course, are opposite sides of the political spectrum. But Norman Mailer, being Norman Mailer, counted them both as friends. And we will hear from John Buffalo Mailer, last child of Norman Kingsley Mailer, and Michael Lennon, the guy who's kept the flame going of one of the great writers of all time. We're back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana in the final stretch, a quarter hour remaining, and we're talking about the man born 100 years ago today in Long Branch, New Jersey, Norman Mailer, two-time Pulitzer winner and an American figure in pop culture and literature. And he had, of course, a war record that was exceptional as he was sent away as a young man, graduate of Harvard as an extremely young man. When did he graduate from Harvard? How old was he, Michael Lennon?
He was graduated in 1943. He was 20 years old and went into the Army the following year in 1944.
There you go. And it changed his life. And as some would say, it made him a man, and for good reason. He was in warfare in World War II in the Pacific. Now, John Buffalo Mailer was born after Vietnam, and Norman Mailer, he won another Pulitzer for Armies of the Night, but John Buffalo Mailer, you come from good stock. I loved your mother, but you're we're talking about Norman, and his parents were fascinating people. They were born in 1891, and how did they meet, and where were they from?
Well, they had to flee, and my grandmother's family came to New York and New Jersey, and my grandfather went to South Africa, and England ended up, he was a terrible gambler, my grandfather, and quite a ladies man as well. And finally, his family kind of didn't want to have much to do with him, and he ended up coming to America and staying with some cousins, and met my grandmother at a hotel that they managed down in the Jersey Shore. And it's kind of extraordinary to think how they had to, you know, traverse the world to meet up in Jersey. But it makes me think about all the different choices that go into how we come to be. But as it were, they got married and had my father and then my incredible aunt, who's 95 now.
Yeah. Well, one of the chapters, and this is an interview with Michael Lennon in 2008 in Provincetown, where Norman Mailer spent a lot of his time. This is a quote from Norman. "Hitler has been on my mind since I was 9 years old. By 1932, my mother was already sensitive and intensely so to the dangers he presented. After Hitler came to power in 1933, everything that happened in Nazi Germany used to cause my mother pain. It was as if she knew in advance what was going to occur. She'd grown up with a knowledge of the anti-Semitism her father had to face in Lithuania. Then as a child going to school in Long Branch, New Jersey, kids on the street would call her Christ Killer." So Michael Lennon, Norman Mailer had some fascinating parents that shaped him.
Yes, he did. He was shaped. His mother, of course, was the engine of the family, the armature of it. His father was more distant, but his father presented gave him a model of what a rebel was, because Barney Mailer was always a rebel. And he had an odd relationship with Norman. They grew closer as the years went on, and Norman realized that his father and his mother, while they stayed together all the time, were very different people. And he talked a lot about his father at the end of his life when I was interviewing him the last few years, and how much he admired his father, even though his father broke a lot of social norms. That interview you're talking about was done, you know, close to the end of his life, was when The Castle in the Forest came out. And Jim, I'd like to add that a lot of the pieces in this book are really uncollected or unpublished. So while there's a lot of material in it from Norman's early novels, from his classic books like Armies of the Night and Miami and the Siege of Chicago, the Presidential Papers, a lot of the other stuff is pretty obscure. It came from interviews that John and I found, or transcripts from films, European documentaries in which he was quoted at length. We really did a real clean sweep through almost everything he did. All of his letters, for example, we found unpublished letters that we put in here. So about half the book, most people won't have read. It'll be new Mailer.
That's
and
great.
The other half will be some of the old chestnuts.
And I just got my copy, A Mysterious Country, and it's from the son, John Buffalo Mailer, and Michael Lennon. And it is about this man who was born 100 years ago today in Long Branch, New Jersey. Tomorrow we'll remember Ernest Gaines, the great Louisiana writer who would have been 90 on January 15th, and he died a few years ago in lovely Oscar, Louisiana, with his wife Diane near him. And the end was tough for Norman Mailer, but he was a fighter, wasn't he? John Buffalo, he did not go down without a fight, did he?
He never went down without a fight. But you know, Jim, if I may, just to add on to the lineage from whence he came. His mother's father was an unofficial rabbi, kind of like a radical rabbi who was respected, but was not part of the actual system that was there. And he was, you know, Norman had this almost prophetic quality about him from the time he was born, by all accounts. I think about how one of the in terms of how his thoughts relate to the situations we're navigating today. One of his obsessions was violence, and you know, you can look at any number of reasons why he was obsessed with violence. But I think it was misinterpreted when he was living as if he was glorifying violence, and that was not the case. He was obsessed with violence because our country was founded on violence. I mean, it's in our blood and in our lack of roots.
No doubt.
And today, you know, we look at how many mass shootings are happening each month. And so this notion of it's essential to explore the fundamental urge towards violence that we see in so many Americans, you know, that is a component of finding a solution to the problems. You know, we need to mine the depths, because we do ourselves no favors by sticking our heads in the sand and hoping the problem will go away. And in the day and age we live in, it's so hard to say anything because it gets broadcast and the polarization police come in and everyone's getting hit for speaking their minds. But I think one of the major points that this book hopefully makes is that we need to have these tough conversations and we need to explore the scary, dark stuff so we can shine the light on it. I think that's what he was always trying to do.
Well, he was unafraid to write about sex and race and violence. He was a fearless man in the way he lived and in the way he wrote. And as you mentioned, both of you, that he thought seriously about running for president in 1996, and he would have run against William Jefferson Clinton, who I'm sure Norman viewed in some ways as a lightweight, but and he had dated your mother prior to her meeting Norman. But here is Norman Mailer on Robin Dow's found him from the Charlie Rose Show talking about Bill Clinton.
Biggest problems facing America and facing Clinton are race and income disparity, the separation between the haves and the have-nots. But you believe in voting for Clinton that he has a better shot at doing something about those, because on race, he has a resonance with the black community.
Black people feel that he understands them, and I think they're right to a degree. He understands them. He sympathizes with them to a degree, to the degree he's able to sympathize with them, because finally, his heart may belong a lot to black people, but his legs have to be marching in the other direction most of the time. You know, it's unforgivable that he signed that welfare bill when, in fact, why don't they get rid of corporate welfare? Much more money is spent aiding corporations than is spent giving money to the poor. And the middle class is paying for the money that goes to the corporations. If the middle class is mad about the money that's going to the poor, they want to get a lot madder about the money that's going to the wealthy.
Corporate welfare.
Yes.
Do you ever talk to him about these things when you see him and talk to him about leadership and about greatness and about what you think greatness is all about?
Do you know, Leon Trotsky once said, certain questions answer themselves by being asked. I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
With my ideas, how often do you think he would invite me in to talk to him?
There we go. Norman Mailer, of course, he was the intellectual match for any man or woman he met individually. And Bill Clinton and he did meet a few times. But John Buffalo Mailer, when you think of your dad's immense legacy, I know you have played catch up about his life before you were born, but 100 years now since he was born, and I think there's a message in there about America that not only is in this book, but for all of us to absorb and perhaps to appreciate about your father.
Oh yeah, I mean, if I had to boil it down to one message, I would say it's about building bridges and raging against the polarization that's being thrust upon us these days. You know, he was writing about Barry Goldwater back in 64 and trying to understand not only why Goldwater was the way he was, both, you know, as a man and as a politician, but why he had appeal to such a large swath of young people, of you know, angry people, of all of it. He wasn't trying to write Goldwater off. He was trying to understand him. And when I look at the ways in which we are trapped in echo chambers where the only voices we hear are those that agree with us, it's a recipe for disaster. I think we could all use a little more of trying to see where the other side is coming from.
Well said. And as J. Michael Lennon noted a few moments ago, who has gone through all of Norman's writings, which were prolific, there are many messages and words in this book that have never been published, including an amazing letter that Norman Mailer wrote to Jimmy Carter when Carter took office. And the book is A Mysterious Country. Thank you, both of you gentlemen. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support.